Hey everyone, this is RT Bear, and I'm going to be on the Cave of Solitude podcast, so tune in, and I got a Kickstarter out right now, so get out and pledge. Thank you.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Cave of Solitude, your comic book and pop culture podcast. I am your host, Eric Anthony. And this week's episode was a real pleasant surprise. I had the pleasure of talking with another nearly 30-year veteran in the comic book industry. My guest this week is renowned penciler, inker, and writer, Mr. R.T. Bear. Now, for me, what's special about someone like Mr. T. Bear is that it's usually the more oriented, hardcore-oriented comic book fan who can really appreciate the value and importance of what someone of R.T.'s caliber brings to the table. Now, it's really easy to read a comic book and notice the top billing of the writer and artist, but when you've read comics for a long time, you start to realize that a lot of what you're seeing and enjoying is in large part due to the embellishments and finished art of the inker. How so? Well, imagine, if you will, you're trying to experience or watching your favorite blockbuster movie, and you're seeing the raw footage, the raw CGI, with everything in let's say 320 instead of 1080p or 4K for that matter. Now, the story's there, the motion and actors are there, but obviously you're not going to be quite as engaged since what you're seeing is essentially unfinished. Now, that's the best way I can think to describe an inker's contribution to a comic book and the story. And a great inker like R.T. Bear can really enhance your experience of getting lost in these stories. So it was a real pleasure for me to be able to chat with the man who's worked on some of my favorite books, literally my favorite books as a child, including The Adventures of Superman in the first run that Dan Jurgens did in the early 90s, and later on in the Ultimate Spider-Man with Brian Michael Bendis and Mark Bagley run, which is, you know, classic in itself. Of course, there's numerous X-Men books that he's worked on, and most recently, he's been working on the DC Rebirth titles such as Action Comics, again reunited with Dan Jurgens. And, I mean, if you've been reading DC Rebirth, I gotta say I'm really, really happy with the way that they've written Superman, bringing back the Superman we're all familiar with. And originally, Art and Dan Jurgens were the ones who put Lois and Clark together, engaged them. So now to see them, these same two characters that we recognize married and with a child, it's come full circle. And now he's going to be moving on to Superwoman, staying in the Superman family. But for this episode, the main focus was R.T. Bear's Kickstarter book, The Art of R.T. Bear, Oodles and Doodles and Other Stuff Too, featuring original art where he gets a chance to flex his muscles as a penciler and really showcase his diversity of talents. Now, the good news is the book has reached its goal and then some, but there are still a few days left to unlock some of the other tiers and some of the stretch goals that we have, which include such things as adding a dust jacket to the book, original art that you might be getting, bonus books that come with it, etc., etc. We get into a lot of detail about that as we get into the interview. So this was really exciting for me. It came out of the blue. I was so happy to do it, and I'm happy to share it with you. So without further ado, this is my conversation with R.T. Bear in the Cave of Solitude, and if you are over 21 and you've listened to this intro, you might make a drinking game out of this intro for the amount of times that I said the word art or the name art. So without further ado, R.T. Bear on the Cave of Solitude.
Thanks for doing this.
Oh, thank you so much for being up for doing it. This is a real treat for me. I wasn't expecting this to happen so quickly, so this is really exciting.
Oh, good. I'm glad.
Yeah. I've been doing a lot of research these past couple of days, making sure that I am aware of all of the things that I did see your stuff in. And, man, I can't believe how many things from my childhood, like all the Superman stuff that I grew up reading before I could read, is so great.
Oh, awesome. I'm glad. Yeah.
All that, the Dan Jurgens stuff. It was actually a friend of mine, another podcaster, brought it to my attention. It was, do you remember the issue 469 where Superman fights Dreadnought? And I think it's on like the 4th of July, and he just kicks his butt the whole time. It was fantastic.
Thanks.
Yeah. Okay.
So I'm just going to open up with a little intro for you. And then is there anything that you don't want us to touch on or talk about?
Not that I can think of.
Okay, awesome. Cool. And you got 45 minutes, right? I don't want to take more of your time than you can handle.
Well, we'll see how it goes. Yeah, but so what is it, like 4:30 now?
Yeah.
California time.
Yeah. Okay, awesome. Okay, so here we go. I'm going to press the record. So this week in the Cave of Solitude, we have a real treat. It's a triple threat in the cave this week. We've got a penciler, an inker, and a writer. And if you've read comics in the last 3 decades, your comic reading experience has been enhanced by this guest's work on titles such as The Adventures of Superman, Ultimate Spider-Man, numerous X-Men books, and recently Action Comics from DC Rebirth, and now he's moving on to ink Superwoman. So we'd like to welcome to the show artist extraordinaire Art T-Bear. Art, how are you doing?
Hey, good. Thanks for having me. Good to be on the show.
Oh, it's our pleasure to have you here. So I don't want to start the show off on a somber note, but it's quite newsworthy that we've lost a legend in comics this past week. And I saw that you posted on Facebook a little note about Len Wein and how you had the privilege of working on some of his stuff in the past. Did you get a chance to meet him throughout your career?
Oh, yeah. He lives here in California. So a lot of the shows, that even like when DC would have preview nights for their movies and stuff, like release previews, Batman, Superman, and Green Lantern and all those, he would always be there, so I'd hang out with him. I think after Green Lantern, we had lunch together. So, he was a great guy. He's done so much amazing work. It's amazing bad to think that he's not here anymore.
Yeah, definitely. Sorry, especially because he was, a friend of yours. I'm really sorry for your loss as well. You got to ink some of the stories that he wrote. Which ones were they again? Remind us.
I actually penciled it. It was, I'm not sure if he created it, but it was a character named the Human Target. And it was a TV series with, what is that guy's name? The guy that sang that song, Jesse's Girl, Rick Rigfield. Yeah,
yes,
Rick Rigfield played Human Target, and it was a short-run TV series, and Lynn had wrote the story. I inked it, or I penciled it. I'm so used to saying inking. I penciled it, and Dick Giordano, the amazing Dick Giordano, inked
Man.
It up. So the sad thing is, for whatever reasons, the powers that be, it never saw print. So I still have all the pages here.
That's
so
great.
Yeah, I'll never let them go just because they mean so much to me. And it was a book that I penciled early on. It was probably like my third or fourth actual assignment from DC.
Wow, that's quite the memento, especially with those two like industry giants. Like, people have so many good things to say about those guys, so to pencil something from them, that's great.
Oh yeah.
Did you have a favorite creation of Len Wein's, or a favorite story that he wrote that you maybe read when you were growing up, or while you were even in the business, that you look back on fondly?
Well, of course. One thing, the Bernie Wrights and stuff and all that was pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And Wolverine is just so iconic. And when Wolverine hit the scene, mm-hmm. it just blew my mind. So, yeah, and just even stuff like that he's edited, like The Watchmen. And
yeah.
I mean, done so much stuff over the years. It's pretty amazing that somebody could do that much work, important work, too.
Yeah, his track record, like when I was just thinking about some of the things he created, but then even if he didn't write the story, the things that he scripted, like his contributions were like through and through fantastic. So I was really, really saddened to hear that he was not with us no more. But it's good to have to hear anecdotes from, some of his friends and people that knew him. Let's talk about good stuff now. I want to talk about this Kickstarter going on, the art of R.T. Bear, Oodles and Doodles and other stuff. How did this all come together? Tell us about it, because it's pretty exciting to even see it on the Kickstarter, the little video you got for it. Tell us about it, Art.
Yeah, it's a 60 pages now. We financed the first kick, the first stretch goal. And so, yeah, it's 60 pages now. It's a hardcover. It's a little oversized, so it's bigger than a comic book. And it's full color, and it encompasses 30 years of my career. So there's pencils, drawings, some of my Marvel stuff, my X-Men stuff. There's Superman stuff in there. There's cover work that I've done for both Marvel and DC. And there's commissions and pinups and just all kinds of stuff from the past 30 years that I've kind of put together in this one collection. And just decided to put it out as a Kickstarter to see if anybody actually cared. And apparently people do, because it's doing pretty darn well right now.
Yeah, no, it's doing fantastic. Like, when I was searching for the Kickstarter after I heard your one of your other episodes on a podcast, I was like, oh, man, this is doing great. So that's good to see the support. Were you surprised at the support that you got? Did you think you had sort of following?
Well, I've been doing this so long, and most artists, like comic book artists specifically, will tell you it's working in a vacuum, because we don't really know how people are, you know, accepting the work, or, you know, not accepting, or just any kind of real feedback. So we kind of work in a vacuum in our little studios, and so it's always interesting for me, you know, when I go to conventions or I do get outside of these four walls, and to see how people really really kind of think of the work. And and so this is actually, you know, people putting money in it and time and supporting and things like that. So yeah, it always is. It's reassuring. It makes me feel good that there is a fan base, especially after 30 years of doing this, that really like what I'm doing and respect it and will actually spend money for it. So it's great. I mean, for me, for my ego, all those other good things.
Right.
The one thing I do like about it as well is because I think people think, you know, one thing of a person, mm-hmm. and then sometimes there's other sides of their personality or sides of their talent that don't get to be shown as much. And then when they do, people are like, whoa, you can do that too.
Right.
So I thought, One of the reasons I wanted to do the book is just to show that there's another side to me too, because most of the stuff I do, high profile, is inking for Marvel and DC.
Right.
But I have penciled a lot of books, and I have penciled a lot of high profile stuff in the past. But, you know, most people see, you know, the inks, because that's, you know, the majority of the work that's out there. And so it's nice to see that people are supporting not just the inking side of me, but also the penciling side, the more, you know, the other creative side of me, you know, that creates books, that writes books, that pencils, you know, stuff like that. So I'm not just one thing, you know, multifaceted.
Right. So on that note, were you becoming a little bit frustrated that you are kind of known as an inker? Like, you even said when we started the show, you're like, I always have a tendency to call myself an inker, but you're so many other things, especially, you know, being a comic artist and writer, and you've got some creator-owned books under your belt. So were you getting frustrated with that labeling?
It's not so much the labeling. It's just, I don't even know if it's frustration. It's just a willingness or a desire to show that I can do other things.
Right.
But it wasn't so much like, you know, like I had a mat on and I had to show the world anything like that. It was more just like, hey, look at this other stuff that I do, and what do you think of it? And so by the support that, you know, I'm getting on the book, it does validate, you know, you in a certain way, and makes you feel kind of like, well, yeah, people do appreciate the contribution. People do appreciate not just the inks, but these other aspects of, you know, my creative life as well. So, yeah.
That's great. So How did you decide what to include in this collection? Because originally it was 52 pages. Oh. Now you're jumping up to 60, which is great. So how did you, with all the stuff that you worked on, how do you decide what fits into this collection?
That's a great question. To be honest, I still don't have it all in stone, especially the extra 8 pages.
Yeah.
But still kind of up in the air a little bit.
Okay.
I do have a good bones, I guess, of the book. So I have it all laid out, and I have had the majority of it planned out. But there's stuff like maybe I can say it here and maybe with your listeners, maybe they can comment, but there's some creative or creator-owned stuff that I've done that I've never seen print, and they were mostly done as animation pitches and things like that for Hollywood. So I was kind of wondering if people would want to see those things as well. So they're in a somewhat comic book style, but
right.
They're not really comic book illustrations. So I was wondering if maybe people would want to see that. So that's kind of where some of the stuff's up in the air. So I'm just not sure, like, what, you know, like how far I should go with it. Should it be things that people are familiar with,
mm-hmm.
or should it be all stuff that, you know, that maybe people haven't seen before?
So if you had whatever you want to do, just all of your own, would, you know, have interest in it, or do you enjoy as much drawing the profile well-known character?
You know, diplomatic, but true. That I like both, and I it would probably be a sad day if I ever had to choose between the two.
Right.
Because I do like the mainstream superhero stuff so much, and always have since I was a kid. But I also like to write and create my own project as well. So I don't know if there would ever be a time where I would completely walk away from one to do the other.
Mm-hmm.
I would like it to be both, but the only problem with that is that sometimes the creator-owned properties take so long to develop
right.
that if you did just focus on the one, you'd probably get it done a lot quicker, you know?
Right, yeah. Yeah, it seems like it's one of those things where it becomes a labor of love because you got to keep the day job that's paying you the bills and giving you the consistent work, but that real project, that your passion project, takes a lot longer because you're fitting it in to the schedule, right?
You sound like you've done this.
No, I've just listened to you guys enough to try to understand the because, you know, we as fans, we look at it like, oh, they're so lucky. They're basically getting to play with all the toys that we love and tell stories and draw pictures. But when you hear the life of an artist or an inker and the deadlines they got, like, it is a real, it's a tiring job. Like, you guys work a lot harder than most 9-to-5 people.
Oh, thank you. It is fun, and it is because you love it. But yeah, it can be pretty daunting. I tell a lot of new people that I talk to at shows and stuff like that. I say it's like a marathon, so you can't burn yourself out too quick. You got to just realize that as much as you want to put all yourself into this one book or this one panel or whatever, you got, you know, like 6 more on that page to do, and then you got 20 more pages left after that, and then you have another book for next month and so on and so on. So you always have to be kind of moving forward and not spending too much time in the press, you know, just kind
right. So which, with that type of a schedule and constantly, like, fortunately enough, you've been able to have, like, almost nearly a 3-decade career. Do you prefer having a long run on a certain book and working with a particular artist and team, or do you like being able to mix it up and doing 4 issues here and maybe moving on to another title and coming back? What helps you to stay sane?
I like long runs.
Okay.
I like long runs the best. I think it's good for the readers and it's good for the creative team, because sometimes it takes a while to kind of find your stride on a book or on a character.
Right.
So if you only have like 1 issue or you only have 2 issues, sometimes before you can even get to the good place, you're already moving on. And so sometimes I don't think it's necessarily beneficial for the reader or for the artist. So, like I always thought, like it takes me at least a half an issue to kind of, if I'm inking, to warm up on a penciler. You know, not that the early pages are bad or anything, but I think when the magic, you know, when you really start getting into that place, is about the midway point on an issue. You kind of start, you start finding that niche. And so sometimes I talk to other people, other, you know, artists as well, and they're like, as soon as I kind of figure out, like, the character's rhythm and find the character beats and how to really show the mannerisms of this character or that character, then I'm moving on to the next book. So I think it gets a little tough, and I also think that one of the good things about a run is that there's a little bit of, not ownership, but I can't think of a better word, of the characters and of that run. So then you start feeling like it's a little bit more of you that you're putting in. You feel a little bit more connected to it.
Absolutely.
You, like one issue or two issues, yeah. So you take a little bit more pride, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. So I want to get back to the Kickstarter, but I want to ask you, where did that initial love for comic books come from? Can you remember like a time as a child or maybe a teenager, that point of no return when you knew that this was what you wanted to do as a career? Or did you have a different idea at some point?
Oh, no. My die was cast at probably 5 years old.
Oh, wow.
With Adam West on that cowl, you know, and showed up on his Batman. I lost my crap. Like, as a kid, I didn't know that it was campy or, you know, like...
No, not at all.
Yeah, like, I thought it was real, and so it was amazing to me. And I think I was already kind of getting the Batman comics at the time, too. So I don't remember what happened first, or if it was all kind of happening at the same time, where I would get comic books and like Batman comic books, and then watch the Batman show as well. And so I think the die was cast early on, and I never really thought about that I could make a living doing it or anything. I just kind of started drawing comics as a kid and things, and one thing just led to another. But even as an adult, I never really thought about it as a profession. I kind of fell into it. But yeah, I would say that it was definitely that silly Batman show.
So once you started drawing as a kid and you fell in love with Batman, I mean, for all the people that like to make fun of the Adam West Batman, I think for the majority of us, it's the reason why we like Batman, that first introduction of like believing in the character. But from there, was there, you know, the art school, and then that, how'd you break into Marvel or DC? What was that path like?
What I did is I kind of got out of comics when I was a teenager, so I only read them when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And so once I got into, you know, rock and roll and cars and girls and stuff like that, I kind of walked away from it. And it was just kind of a weird long story, but I'll try to make it short.
No problem.
I was hurt real bad right out of high school, and so I was bedridden for a long time.
Oh, no.
And so Pacific Comics was coming out, and they were kind of a precursor to Image.
Okay.
And they were San Diego-based as well, as like the Jim Lee Wildstorm Studios. And so they were putting out more adult kind of comics, and the reason I compare them to Image is because they had like creator-owned by Jack Kirby, Neil Adams, and Bernie Wrightson and people like that. I do believe that Rocketeer debuted there as well.
Okay.
So they were more adult comic books, and also I started reading more of like the Savage Sword, John Buscema stuff. So
right.
I kind of got back into comic books through the more adult comic book stuff. So I wasn't reading so much the superhero as just those adventure stories and the more adult, you know, sci-fi stuff and things. And then I just had a sketchbook because I was bedridden, and I would just start drawing from those things and just drawing and kind of rediscovering my love for drawing. And the doctor told me I wouldn't really be able to work like physically because of my back and stuff like that. So then I had to start rethinking my life a little bit, And so then I started thinking, well, I do like drawing. So then I went to art school, but just like community college stuff, nothing, because I couldn't really afford it.
Right.
But I was still, I was out of my house and I was working, you know, to support myself. So I could only afford to go to college at night and things like that. What I really wanted to do is illustration.
Okay.
I didn't really want to do comic books, so I started studying illustration, and I got jobs in L.A. as an illustrator, and so I was always going to school during all this process, and then a teacher actually knew a guy that was doing comic books, and this guy knew Jim Valentino, and so Jim Valentino, the image guy of Guardians of the Galaxy,
yep.
Shat Fuck, you know, that stuff. And so I started working in the studio with Jim. And so I was inking all of his Myth Adventures books and stuff like that and kind of learning the trade. And just as, you know, fate would have it, it was paying me better and more consistently than the illustration stuff was. Because that's real, you know, kind of hit and miss. And I had to go into L.A. all the time and audition,
right.
Steal portfolios around, things like this. And this was kind of steady work. And then... actually, that work, we would, it's weird, indies are really interesting because sometimes you get paid, sometimes you don't. And so Jim and I stopped kind of getting our secondary payments once the book would come out. It's, like I said, it's a long story, but I realized I needed to kind of find something that was more reliable than independent comics.
Of course.
So that's when I just decided I was going to work for Marvel or DC, and it was more just like, my naive, like, sensibility is like, oh, yeah, because the checks won't bounce. You know what I mean?
Yeah, right.
They're a reputable company.
Exactly.
And they're steady, you know, and all that other stuff. So then, yeah, I just started, you know, put a portfolio together and started working or showing around and got work at Marvel and DC. So that's how I stayed, you know, in the comics, because I think it was fortuitous because illustration in that sense doesn't really exist anymore.
Right.
So I think comic books is the better move. You know?
And you're returning back to that original love too, right? Like it all came full circle in a way.
Oh yeah, because I started, as I was doing it, I started, you know, realizing, hey, comics are pretty cool. And also when I got back in, you know, I'm working professionally, is when, or just before, you know, Frank Miller's Year One, or Dark Knight Returns, Ronin, Year One,
right.
And Alan Moore's Watchmen, and all that other stuff. So there was more adult, you know, kind of content coming out.
More sophisticated stuff, yeah.
Right, and so it was actually kind of like, yeah, this is pretty darn cool, you know, being part of this now. And getting back into it, and then re-experiencing the childhood, you know, love for all these characters and stuff. So it's been a pretty good run.
Yeah, that's a great story, by the way, about, you know, something bad that you had experienced, and then having, you know, being reintroduced to comic books and reading those. What did it give you a sense of comfort? Because I hear a lot of people talk about their love for comic books, and it usually goes back to a comforting memory. So was that kind of what it was for you at that time, considering the circumstances of what you were facing?
Well, I think as a kid, I got a lot of comfort out of the fact that there were these heroes that were kind of looking out for us,
right.
You know, and had our back. And I think I found comfort in that. And then as an adult, I think I just really loved the art form.
Right.
You know, storytelling with visuals. And I love expressing myself with ink. So one of the main things in comic books is ink. So, you know, I think it was when I was more as an adult, it was more just the art aspect of it.
Right. So from a fan perspective, because I can hear in your voice that you were such a fan of this stuff, did you have a favorite artist that you were inspired by or influenced heavily by as an artist yourself?
I think as a kid, I didn't know any artist from any other artist.
Right.
Although, if you look back at my, you know, my stuff, you know, from when I was a kid, there are like reoccurring artists. So I must have, even though I wasn't conscious of it,
yeah,
I was buying those one artist's work, even though I didn't really know their names or anything like that. And then I think early on it was like George Perez and Neil
right.
Adams and Walter Simonson and
yeah.
and guys like that. And I just absorb everything that's being done even today. So I just love style. I love the way people in this industry are able to express themselves within the medium, and how many different ways that they can express themselves within the same format,
right?
And things like that. So I really love style, and I love to see how all these guys express themselves in those different ways. And so those are the things that keep me interested, and those are the things that keep me excited. You know, when I see somebody, it's like, wait a minute, I didn't think we could go any further, or that there was anything else to contribute to the art form. And then there's some guy or even myself, you know, bringing something up and kind of changing things around. So yeah, it's exciting. Even after 30 years, I'm still really excited about the prospects.
That's awesome. Speaking of that, when you said how you see people express themselves within the medium in so many different ways, or even being surprised, it was like, oh my goodness, we could do that now. From when you started, and you started during a time where they were taking a lot of steps forward with the medium as far as, you know, The Dark Knight Returns and The Watchmen, seeing that, living through that as a person in the industry, what can you say now has changed from what you've seen from when you started working on these books, when there was still, you know, newsstand, to now, you know, the style of writing and the layouts and all those type of things have changed? What are some of the biggest differences you see?
Well, for me, as an artist, the biggest thing is when I started, there was no Federal Express, so that's how old I am. So we had to go to the post office. And I remember both DC and Marvel wouldn't let you just send one page. You'd have to send a bundle, because also it was just such a pain in the butt, you know, to go there every day and drop off a page and pack it and, you know, all that other stuff. So usually you would go at the end of the week, maybe four times a month, you know, you would drop off a package. They'd have to weigh it and then, you know, charge you appropriately and stuff. And I think Marvel and DC would reimburse you for it, but you had to pay it initially out of your own pocket. So that was kind of a pain. And so then Federal Express came around, and that was like a godsend. Like, wait a minute, you guys will, you know, we have these drop-off boxes, or you'll come right to the door and pick stuff up. This is amazing. And then it's next day delivery. Oh my gosh, it was amazing. And so now, you know, we have the digital revolution, so we can simply scan a page and then send it right in to our editors. So, you know, we don't even have to deal with Federal Express. So I think just that has been, you know, there's been a lot of changes. I know that's probably boring for your listeners, but
no.
For me, those are like some major changes. And I think just as the industry itself, as the art form, is one big thing is just printing and computer coloring.
Mm.
You know, so the printing, the neat thing about the printing is I can do more detailed work,
yeah,
because with the scanners and the printing technology that we have now, the work can become way more detailed and can be more subtle than it used to be. Used to have to, because it was on newsprint and it was
right.
bad printing, you know,
right.
presses and things like that. You had to have like thicker lines, and you really had to express yourself in a bolder way, I guess, a more brash way.
Okay.
And now there's a way of being, I guess, a little bit more subtle with the work, less in your face, a little bit more realistic. Your hatching can be finer. You can be more detail-oriented. And then with the colors on top of that, a good colorist will enhance the work and not distract from it. So all your little nuances, if they can kind of, you know, accent it, then you have this great, you know, harmony of stuff. And also the neat thing about even like bad computer coloring, is that the clarity is always way better than, you know, the dots on a page.
Yeah.
So for color processing and things of the old comic books.
Right.
And the old comic books kind of fade and things like that, and the new comic books kind of, they kind of hold their quality a lot longer.
Right.
Yeah.
So does it excite a lot of you and your peers when things that you guys worked on during that time where the printing quality was, you know, poor, or you had to, you know, you couldn't really see how fine the work was because of that fact, and now all of these things are being reprinted and restored in a way that we can fully enjoy it like it's new again? What's it like for you guys to see that stuff come back?
Well, sometimes it's like, oh my gosh, I'd rather people don't see that.
Right.
Because like I said, there was a lot of, there was a lot of forgiveness with the bad printing too, you know what I mean? Like, so
sure.
Sometimes the line might not be as crisp and clean as, you know, you might have thought. And then when they do it in the higher quality, you're like, no, I'd rather stay the way it was. I was going through some old artwork, and I penciled and inked a Cable series for Marvel. It was the Cable ongoing with Baby Nicieza as the writer, and I had some covers, and one piece in particular that they used for the Diamond catalog cover, and I think it was one of the covers of the book, and it was also a retail poster of Cable, and I found the original. I didn't think I still had it, but I found it, and I was like, holy moly. And so I looked at it, and I was kind of looking at it like, oh my gosh, these lines are a little kind of crusty. They're a little dirty. And so I scanned it in the computer, and I didn't intend on doing this, but I just kind of went in there and digitally re-inked it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, cleaned it up, simplified, thinned things out, and just kind of made it, you know, like articulated it in a crisper way. And I was like, this is really kind of cool. And so I had my friend Thomas Mason color it up, and it's one of the key pieces in the Kickstarter campaign. So it's kind of a before and after section in the Kickstarter, Oodles and Doodles and Other Stuff Too book. And yeah, I was really proud of it, and it came out really good, and Thomas did an amazing color job. So it almost, you know, it's from the 90s, so it still has kind of the 90s sensibilities, but it looks contemporary.
Right.
And I think if I could do my work like that, I could be very proud of it. If I could go back in and kind of digitally augment it a little bit and then kind of get some new, you know, colors on it, I think that would be ideal. But yeah, I hope people like that when they see it in the Kickstarter book.
Well, that would keep you working for a while if they called you back to re-ink and retouch all the stuff that you were. We're reprinting this Superman collection. Go back and redo it. That'd be good.
It might be pretty daunting, though, if you think about it. It's like 30 years. It'd take me another 30 years to clean it all up.
Yeah, so you'll be employed for a while. That'd be a good thing. You mentioned working through the 90s, and you were one of the artists who was part of the Image movement in the early days of it. Can you tell us a little bit about what that experience was like during that whole era of the boom and then the bust of the comics in the 90s, the big creativity, and then a lot of the things that weren't so great? Tell us a little bit about those stories.
The only thing I can really like sum up the early days, the beginning days, is like it's every decadent rock star, like, you know, rock star story you've ever heard. Like it was like that crazy.
Really?
Like there were lines around the block at these signings and stuff like that.
Yes.
Books were selling millions of copies. If I was some rocker in the 90s, I would have like a room full of gold albums because those books were selling millions of copies.
Right.
So I'd have gold and platinum like albums on the wall. I always think like, why? Why didn't we get like gold albums or like gold comic books or something selling a million copies? You know, the music industry awards themselves and stuff, but
it's
we
true.
Don't. So
yeah,
it would have been cool, but yeah. So the money was good, the fan support was amazing, and I liked the creative. Just kind of, there wasn't there wasn't somebody looking over your back all the time saying you couldn't do this or you couldn't do that. So it was the sky's the limit. So it felt like we were just inventing stuff and doing things that were possible that we could actually make happen. And, without going through a corporation or somebody that would say, oh, it's too much money or no, you're not good enough or, whatever the restrictions were. So it was actually pretty amazing because you could just dream unabashedly. You didn't have any restrictions. You could just think it and it actually, you could most likely make it happen. And that's a great place to be as a creative person, where you just can think about, I might want to do this.
Sure.
And then you could actually make it happen, versus, having to go through channels or waiting for money to be there or, those different things. And I don't mean to keep harkening back to the Kickstarter thing, but that's why I like Kickstarter too, because Kickstarter, it takes it right to the fans. They can fund it almost like they're funding a movie or something like that.
Right.
You know how movies get producers and producers then try to, allocate funds and get people to back the movie so that they can make the movie. And I like that aspect because in Kickstarter feels to me like the old Image days where I could actually start dreaming again, about doing this or doing that. And it's not like I couldn't do that because I could probably go to Image and do a book, but with Kickstarter, I could actually, within a month, I know whether the product is going to sink or swim. And
sure,
then I can still take that product and I can put it into a bookstore or I can get a publishing deal or I can do other things with it. So it becomes financially a great way to do things. You know what I mean? Because it's not just waiting for somebody to give you money or putting out, spending a year or two on a project, putting it out, and then having it maybe not be supported, by the fans. So at least Kickstarter, within a month, whether they're going to support it or not, so you can, and also along the campaign, you can switch it up and you can change it up and you can talk to those people and they can tell you maybe why they don't like it or why they like it. So, it's a great interactive experience. I really enjoy it. It's frustrating at times, but I think overall I really enjoy it.
Yeah, that's great. And it's good. It's really good to see the support that you got specifically for this one, because it does let you know, there are a group of people out there who specifically want this. They're going to get what they're paying for, and they're going to be happy. Whereas, a lot of these people put out comics on their own, and then when you go to a convention or you go into, some sort of an indie show, what's separating one from the other, really? If you just put that book there yourself, you can't really know what it is that people are going to want to go for. But with the Kickstarter, definitely there's these people who want it and they're going to get what they're asking for, which is great.
And you can kind of start tailoring it to what they want as well, because you get immediate feedback where, if you went through Diamond or whatever, it takes 3 months before the book even comes out. So, you could solicit it, get your numbers, and then, for 3 months never hear what anybody really thinks about it until the book actually does come out. Yeah.
Yeah, that's great. So speaking of things that you created when you were at Image in those days, I remember it was around 94, 95. Do you remember Heroes Illustrated? They were like the Wizards competition.
Oh, yeah. They were great, yeah.
Yeah, it was. They put out this magazine on the newsstand. It was a who's who in comics. And I remember vividly the cover was two characters that I had never heard of before. Throughout the book, they separated it with, your mainstream characters, gave a biography of them, and then it went into all the newly created characters. But on the cover was black and white, the characters that you created. So can you tell us a little bit about that creation that you came up with back in those days?
Well, it was like, I was saying, I had this idea, and I pitched it to Rob Liefeld. Rob liked it, and then pitched it to the Image guys, the Image founders. They liked it, so then, I got to move forward on a three-issue deal and storyline with those two characters. So it was a dream come true. I had absolutely Well, I had a little bit of an idea what I was doing, but it was just an overall brand new creative experience, and I was elated. It was challenging, but at the same time, it was a lot of fun.
Remind us what the backstory of those characters were, to refresh our memories.
I'd say just read the book.
Read the book.
it's an ex-spy meets a damsel in distress, basically, and Eddie's the guy that can help her, but as in like a more contemporary damsel in distress way, she's not quite incapable of helping herself. So they kind of step up together and right the wrong. So I say just read the book.
Read the book? Okay.
Well, I have it on my campaign. So yeah, I don't want to give too much away, but I'm making them available again on my Kickstarter.
And that's
the Black and White Tier.
That's what I wanted to get into, because it is part of some of the incentive in tiers, right? So can you break down some of the tiers that you got for those that are considering to pledge?
Yeah, I have of course the PDF pledge, and I have a complete digital package for any of the international friends I have out there. So because sometimes the shipping gets a little bit expensive, so
yeah.
I pretty much put the whole campaign into a digital format so they could get. And I don't think the black and white stuff's available digitally, but the Chrono Mechanics stuff is. Just because the black and white stuff predates the digital time, so I don't have that in any kind of digital form yet. But I'm hoping to soon. So then I have been the book tier. I have a series of sketches. There's four exclusive mini prints that were put together for the Kickstarter, and so I have those. I have a sketch tier where I do a head sketch in the book. I have a mystery sketch, which is fun, where I have just a collection of sketches that I have over the years. And I went through them, and I found just a big stack of them. So I'm making them available in a mystery sketch tier. So basically, you don't know what you're going to get. So I put all the sketches individually into an envelope. I spray painted a question mark on them. And so the fun part is you're never going to know quite what you're getting. But the fun part is they're always going to be worth at least $30, and it's probably going to be something that you've recognized in the past, you know, a sketch of a cover or something like that that I've done. So a lot of preliminary stuff and things like that that are going to be there. And then, like I said, I got a black and white tier where I reissue the or make available the original three-issue series. And for Rob Liefeld's Extreme Studios Image 25th anniversary, he asked me to do a piece. So I did the white character from the original black and white, but I kind of made her look contemporary, and so she's all kind of, she's not retro looking anymore. She's more like she could be in a contemporary comic book, and so I did that piece for the Extreme Reunion, and so then I also put that as the cover and making it available as a. One, you can buy the original on a tier, but you can also get the print. And then I have an inker tier where I'll actually give an ink lesson, and I provide blue lines and brush, pen, ink, and even a correction pen if needed. And that cable piece, actually, that I was talking about, the original is available on the site as well. So there's a lot of goodies, and there's goodies that go from like $10 all the way to $5,000, so and everything in between. So
right. Yeah,
so there's a lot of stuff in there. And the one thing is, we've been selling pretty quickly. One of the commissions for the original artwork commissions just went back up into, availability. So there's that. So if anybody has, wants me to draw for them. That just went back up because somebody that had that tier upgraded into the color tier with Thomas Mason and stuff. So okay. He upgraded, but then that tier that he had became available again. So that's the commission tier.
Oh, awesome.
So, yeah. Oh, my wife just told me we went up again. So we're at 24.35.
Oh, fantastic. So,
yeah,
so did we
everybody, yeah.
Did we unlock another another tier? Or another
what's that?
Did it was another tier unlocked? Because I saw that the dust jacket now is going to be added to the book. So what was the next thing that was going to be unlocked?
Oh no! What was unlocked is the extra 8 pages. So
okay,
it went from a 52-page book to a 60-page book. Yeah.
Okay.
But we're about 1,500 away from the next stretch goal, which is that dust cover. And
okay.
I don't know if you just got the new update is Kevin Nolan, the great Kevin Nolan.
I did see that.
He agreed to do the foreword.
Yeah, that's awesome. This is surreal.
Yeah, so he's going to do the foreword for the dust jacket. Yeah, so I really, really hope that dust jacket happens. Because one thing, too, is like the dust jacket is the original cover for the book. And then you know, like dressy cover with the black around it. And then what we can do is we can keep that as the dust cover, but then we get a chance to do a whole new cover for the actual book, which if you look at the site, it's the full piece of white artwork that's the whole cover. So it just looks way more impressive, and it's kind of like you get two cool pieces, you know, in the one, you know, as one cover. So I like that idea.
That's great. It's so good to see it thriving and people being, you know, so interested in it and seeing it unlocking all these next stretch goals. That's awesome. So you've got this Kickstarter, which is obviously turned into a huge success. What's next for you? Because you have said that you want to show your chops as a penciler. Do you ever have the desire to branch out and do either a creator-owned book or get a full pencils title perhaps for DC? Are you working exclusively for DC now?
I'm not working exclusively, but I really like DC a lot, so it's where I would like to stay for a long while, just because I like DC as a company. I think they're pretty amazing.
That's great to hear. So would you want to...
Yeah, I think what I do is I kind of break down my day. So I have my day job,
mm-hmm.
which is my inking. So I do that in the day, and then I work till about dinner time, and then I have dinner with my family, and then the evening is creator-owned stuff. So what I've done in the past is, in that spare time, I did Chrono Mechanics, you know, for Image.
Right.
So I did a 48-page graphic novel, and which I also kickstarted as well later as a trade. And so then what I'm doing now is I'm actually working on revamping Black and White.
That's
and
awesome.
It more as like a reimagine, and I'm hoping to put that out as a Kickstarter sometime within the next year or so. And I write screenplays, and
really?
So I just finished another screenplay. Well, actually, it's my first screenplay, but it seems like another screenplay because it's been 8 years that I've been working on it.
Okay.
And a friend of mine, he's a screenwriter. His name's Matt Hillary. He's done a lot of stuff with Scott Rosenberg's company and things. And so he's helping me out on this, and we're adapting Chrono Mechanics, the graphic novel, to a screenplay. And so we just finished it up a couple months ago. So now I'm just waiting to set up some meetings and start pitching around Hollywood. So, you know, keep your fingers crossed there.
Can you tell us
what
the screenplay is about? Or is it too early to discuss?
It's basically it's adapting the original the first story arc with a dog kind of becoming a Chrono Mechanic
okay.
team member.
Okay.
So it's kind of the origin of a new recruit. So I'd say the beginning of the book is mostly the beginning of the movie, and then the movie goes into uncharted territory. But the movie is kind of like Ghostbusters meets Men in Black. It kind of has that sensibility.
Okay.
And we started working on it before Guardians of the Galaxy came out. But I'd say it probably, now that Guardians is out, it probably has that sensibility as more of a contemporary reference. You know, and when I say Ghostbusters, I remember, I'm talking about the original,
yes,
Ghostbusters, not the new one, which
right.
wasn't bad, but it's more based on that sensibilities than the new one.
Sure. Cool. That's exciting. Well, that's something to look forward to. I can't wait to hear more about it. I have a couple of listener questions for you. I know we're going to wrap up very soon. Is it okay to ask you some listener questions before we sign off?
Sure, let's do it.
Okay. So, a local Toronto artist, Shane Heron, wanted to know who some of your favorite collaborators were over the years that you enjoyed working with, or perhaps someone that you particularly like to ink over.
Well, one of my favorite ink jobs is just because it's so expressive, and I felt like I could just kind of throw lines down and really ink versus trace, or to just go over lines. Was Dave Finch.
Okay.
So I really
liked
working with Dave Finch on the Ultimate X-Men and on the Call of Duty and whatever else. I think we worked on something else, but I can't remember what it was. Maybe Avengers. But so I liked him as an inker. Like I said, I think it was pretty amazing to be able to work off of a Len Wein script.
Mm-hmm.
early on in the day. So that was pretty amazing. So I don't know. I mean, there's so many high points.
Yeah,
there's so many
yeah.
great people I've got a chance to work with over the years. I think Michael Bendis, on Ultimate Spider-Man.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And,
yeah, I love that book.
Mark Miller, on Ultimate X-Men and stuff like that. Those guys are really, really good. And, Dan Jurgens, Jim Lee, Will Sprattasio,
the list is endless.
Lightfield,
Oh man.
Yeah, Eric Larson, Todd McFarlane. I've just been really, really blessed. So I'm really lucky. I've been able to work with a lot of great people.
So, in regards to that, what is your approach to inking? Do you try to fulfill the expectation of what the artist might have of you, or are you trying to, add something that you feel the story may need? Can you explain that a little bit?
I think there's a little bit of all those things. For me, you always want to be respectful to the penciler because it's a collaboration, and you don't want to feel like you're just decimating the person's work, but at the same time, I am an artist and I have a voice,
right?
And I would like to try to express myself as well. So it is really kind of a fine line where you want to kind of bring yourself into the work, but at the same time, be respectful to whoever it is that you're working with. The one thing, like I said earlier about style, is like I'm a child of style. Like I just love style and just studying it and learning it. And so being around it all my life and working as almost my whole adult life in the industry, I kind of see the lineage of a lot of people. So I can see where this guy's style came from or what this guy was studying, what he's looking at. And so when I just look at a penciler now, I can kind of see the decades or the other artists where he might have been looking or what his influences were.
Right.
And so then I can take those influences, not necessarily just from him, but I can take all those other influences and I know where he's coming from, and I can kind of bring that into the work. Because like I said, I kind of study all these styles, and I have for 30 years, so I can kind of see the, if it's a contemporary guy, a guy that's brand new, I can kind of see where he's coming from,
right.
Where his origins were, what he liked. So then it kind of cues me into do I use a brush? Do I use a pen? Do I become more technical? Do I become more inkerly, more organic? What approach to take? So yeah.
Awesome. Adam Chapman, who is the host of the Comic Shenanigans podcast, he wanted to know what is the most common title he's asked that you've been asked to sign at conventions, and the most common thing you get to commission at conventions.
You mean character-wise commission?
Yeah, or character-wise commission and the title that you're most often asked to sign at commissions, maybe something you worked on.
The book I sign the most at conventions is Cable Number One.
Okay.
That I penciled and worked with Fabian on. Yeah, so that's like the number one book. And, I get asked to draw at conventions Batgirl a lot.
Really?
And Wonder Woman a lot. Yeah.
Why do you think that is? That makes people ask you particularly to draw those characters?
I don't know, because what I do is sometimes, like if I'm at a convention, I'll take a picture with the guy that commissioned me to do it. You know, he'll be holding up the image or whatever, and I'll post these things. And so I think people are just responding to the, you know, when I post the images, that I guess they like them and want one for themselves. So I think if you looked at my commissions, it's mostly those two characters, I think. Yeah.
So you hit it out of the park with that first guy asking for that commission, and then people who see it through social media are all giving that, I need a Wonder Woman, or I need a Batgirl from you.
I think that's how it works. I'm not 100% sure, but that's the only way I can explain it, yeah.
Do you have a preference of a character? I always like to ask when I'm getting a commission who the artist enjoys drawing so that they'll, you know, put their best effort into that particular character. Is there someone you particularly like to draw?
I like when I don't see it coming.
Okay.
So I don't like necessarily like really obscure characters,
right,
but like something that I wouldn't have thought of. Like a couple times, you know, somebody's, hey, can you draw Hawkman? I've done a run on Hawkman, but I was like, Hawkman, yeah, that'd be fun. You know, so I've done the more technical, you know, metal helmet looking one,
right,
and then I've done one where it's more like the feathered, you know, winged one. And I like both of them, and I thought they came out good. And I think one of them is going to be in the Oodles and Doodles book.
Oh, awesome! Is there a character you hate when they say, "Can you do this one for me?" Like, oh no, not this one.
Oh my gosh! Actually, I get asked to draw Superman a lot too. Gosh, let me think.
I hear a lot of artists say Iron Man. They hate when they get asked Iron because of the like the moving parts of the suit and stuff.
I did an Iron Man at the San Diego Comic Con, and I thought I was going to hate it for the same reasons, but for some reason, maybe because I was really nervous, I stepped up, and it came out pretty good. So I don't have problems with that. I think sometimes I get asked to draw Swamp Thing.
Okay.
And it becomes a little daunting just because the only way you can really make that character look cool is like with all the vines and things.
Yes.
So when you're at a show, I'm very detail oriented. So it's just like, where do you stop? You know what I mean? Like, how far do you go with the detail?
Right.
So I usually end up spending way more time on Swamp Thing, you know, commissions than anything else. So I still enjoy doing them, but maybe I just don't like them because they take so much time.
Yeah, you don't know that stopping point where, is it finished or can I add another leaf to them or something?
Yeah, there's always room for another vine, right?
Right. Jay Clarkson from the Elegant Weapon podcast wanted me to ask you about your Hack Shack Studios, a little bit about its history and why you started it.
That's a good question. Hack Shack is probably like 25 years old now. And it started with a brilliant inker. He's brilliant now. He was when I was still going to art school, local community college, I was taking a life drawing course, and there was a guy named Trevor Scott. He was really good. He was young. He was really ambitious. And I was getting a little behind on my Adventures of Superman deadline. And so, and I wanted to take on more work because Marvel actually was starting to ask me. I was starting to ink Art Adams on some X-Men work.
Yeah.
And so there was more work coming in. And so I just asked him if he could help me out. And he said, sure. And we just got along so well, we started working together on a regular basis. So the money was good, and we'd get more work. And we were just kind of hanging out at my apartment. My little Huntington, actually it was a Hermosa Beach apartment, inking. I think he had like a little fold-up table that he would use. And it was really humble. And we would just do our comics. And then I started working more with Jim Lee and Will Spartaccio on X-Men Uncanny, you know, X-Men work. And so we actually started doing those books. And with Scott, or when those guys would get into a bind, Trevor and sometimes both of us would end up like helping them out on deadlines. So sometimes Trevor would do backgrounds for Scott Williams and things like that. And so we just started really kind of hanging out with those guys more. And I don't know how the Hack Shack thing just started. So this is the day of fax machines. So I think I just worked up a Hack Shack logo. And Hack Shack was like, it, you know, like a hack is a derogatory term for a bad artist. You know, he's a hack.
Right.
So I think I just thought it was funny, like, oh, we're not hacks, but we're going to call it Hack. And then we worked in this little shack at the beach. So I think it just kind of came out of that. So when I would fax Jim and Wilf and Scott stuff, I just... The letterhead, you know, you're probably too young for this, but you had to have kind of like a letterhead. And so the letterhead was Hack Studios.
Right.
And so then before I know it, those guys start faxing back. What were they at the time? They were Homage. They were Homage Studios. And so then they would start sending, you know, their faxes back, Homage Studios. And so... I remember I was hanging out with Jim Lee one day, and he was very earnest, and he was very sincere, and he took me aside. He goes, Art, he goes, you know, a hack is a bad term for an artist that does horrible work, right? You know that. And I go, yeah, I know. He goes, why would you call your studio Hack Shack? And I go, I just thought it was funny. And he's like, okay. And I just thought it was pretty telling where, you know, they were Homage Studios, where they paid homage to comics and stuff like that.
Right.
And we were like Hack Shack Studios. And so Hack Shack then just became, you know, a thing. So we were doing more books. And so then I put an ad in a local comic shop for help because Trevor and I were doing, you know, all those books, and I think we usually did at least two books, maybe three books a month. And so Danny Mickey, of all people, answered the ad. Danny
Wow.
Mickey, oh my gosh. And so, yeah, he didn't have really much going on at the time. He had some basic skills, but had never really, you know, done anything to this extreme before, no pun intended. And so, you know, one of the things about the studio, too, was it was a learning. You know, it wasn't just like we were working. We were actually kind of learning. And in the early days, Trevor and I were learning kind of together. But by the time Danny came in, we actually had something to, you know what I mean, like teach him. And so, you know, I kind of worked with Danny. And then the big image boom happened.
Mm-hmm.
So then Jim Lee needed support, and Rob Liefeld needed support. So and they were both really cool about it, where Trevor went over to work with Jim at, I guess it was Wildstorm at this point. I don't think it was Homage anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so then he went to San Diego and started working with Jim. And then Danny started working here in Orange County with Rob Liefeld at Extreme Studios. So I still had, I had two other guys that I was working with at the time. So then I kept, you know, Hack Shack going. And then eventually I just went over to work at Extreme Studios with Rob as well. So then I started training a lot of inkers and stuff there, kind of recruiting guys, town scouting for Rob, and just kind of working with the inkers there. And so there, I was working with John Sabal, Marlo Acquiesa. I can't really say his name right, his last name, so I'm sorry, Marlo. Dan Panosian and I brought in, we were inking some Spawn stuff over Greg Capullo, We brought Tim Townsend in to work with us, so Kim kind of started with us as well. And then there's Jaime Mendoza, there's Larry Stucker. And so when Extreme started kind of, you know, and the image boom was kind of dying when the industry was kind of, getting smaller or whatever, the speculators were bailing out. Jaime and I, we left the studio. Well, actually, it was Jeff Matsuda, myself, and a few other people left. And then a lot of those inkers that I was working with, they were kind of like, what should we do? Like, there's not a lot of work here right now, and we don't really have our foot in the mainstream. And they were kind of asking me for advice. So it was mostly like Larry, Stucker, and Jaime at the time. And so I was working on Black and White as an ongoing. So I just asked those guys if they wanted to help me out on that book. And then before you knew it, it was kind of Hack Shack Volume 2 was coming out of that. So that wasn't enough work. So I went back to Marvel after the Image years and brought along Jaime. And we started doing a lot of Marvel books. And so I helped Jaime get a footing in with Marvel. So he was inking Heroes for Hire and a bunch of other books. I was doing X-Men and X-Factor, I think.
And this was during Heroes Reborn era, right? When Heroes for Hire had come out. Okay.
Yeah. It was the Carlos Pacheco X-Men run that I did with him.
Okay.
And so, yeah, we did a lot of other books for Marvel, but those were like the bigger name books. And so then basically the studio just kind of organically built up again. So then, Jaime and I needed help. So then we hired, people to support us. And then those guys became talent. And the next tier of guys that came out was like Andy Owens, who inks a lot of Scott McDaniel's work. He came out of that studio. Sean Parsons, came out of that studio. So, we were still, turning out, talent at that time. So it still kind of exists at this point, but it's scaled down quite a bit.
Right. But it still exists.
You never know.
It's got quite the legacy.
Yeah, you never know.
That's awesome.
Yeah,
I love hearing those stories about how, things all came together, that little bit of history. That's fantastic.
Yeah, so it's just kind of an ink studio that happened organically, and it kind of comes and goes over the decades. And also the studio has done where we were doing Hollywood pitches and things. So the studio has actually done animation and other things too. We've done advertising, stuff like that. So it wasn't necessarily just inking. It was just an all-encompassing creative kind of place to be, with advertising and the Hollywood, animation stuff and things.
Right. Well, that's a great history. What a great question. I didn't think I'd get such a fantastic story out of it. I got to thank him. So
I was putting you to sleep.
No, not at all. I love that kind of stuff. No, I love it. Now that you're back with, or you're not back, but that DC Rebirth is in full swing and it's doing so well, what's it like working on these books that, the New 52 was what it was, and it had a big spike, in interest, and then it kind of dropped off. But now it really feels like DC has all the wheels in motion as far as comics are concerned. How nice is it to have worked on the Action Comics again with Dan Jurgens and returning to that specific version of Superman? What's the experience like for you now?
It really felt like coming home. I was exceptionally proud, and the best thing is I got to kind of relive the experience, just remembering what it was like to work on those books and how special it was, because I worked all the way up to the death of Superman.
That's
and,
right.
You know, we married off Lois and Clark, and we engaged those two, and, you know, there was a lot of stuff that was happening.
That's right.
In those days, which was pretty cool. And I think it was nostalgic, and then it was also moving forward. And I got to do an Action cover that I penciled and inked, so that was really special. And so now I'm working on Superwoman, which is, you know, still Superman family book. And I've been told that I will be back for the Superman, 1000. So, and maybe in a pencil capacity. Yeah, so that's going to be amazing.
Yeah, that's great. Congratulations. That's awesome. You know, Action Comics 1000, the book that kind of got the superhero ball rolling down the hill, to be on that milestone issue, that's going to be a real treat. We're looking forward to that.
Well, let's cross our fingers and hope it happens.
Yeah, I hope it happens too.
You never know in this industry.
No, yeah. No, you don't, but I think it'll happen. So my usual co-host, Martin Duncan, he's the co-host of the Fastball Special, and he always ends the interviews by asking the interviewee what their favorite donut is. Now, keep in mind, we're in Canada, so donuts are really popular here. So he wanted to know what your favorite donut is, if you even eat donuts.
Donuts are popular everywhere, my friend.
It's
Who doesn't
true.
Like a donut?
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. But, I mean, being connected kind of our staple.
Yeah, I'm not a fancy guy. You know those, like, devil's food, like chocolate?
Yeah, I
like those, but this is where it gets weird, okay? I kind of like them when they're a little, like, you know how, like, because they're fried, I kind of like them when the inside, you know, the inside circle,
yeah,
where it's a little crunchy.
Yeah.
I kind of like that.
So a little aged, devil donut a little aged.
Yeah.
That's okay.
Yeah.
We usually...
food with chocolate icing, yeah.
Nice. That's a good pick. I like it. Well, thank you so much again, Art, for giving of your time and talking with us. And we're happy that the Kickstarter is doing so well. And hopefully in the near future, we can have you on again. Maybe when Superman 1000 comes out. I know it's not too far away, but it would be great to have you again as a guest on our show.
No problem. And please, all your listeners, get on Pledge, because there's only a couple more days, and I really want to get that dust jacket into people's hands. I think it would be an amazing upgrade for the book.
Yeah, no problem. Happy to help, and I'm sure you're going to get the support. We're looking forward to it. Thanks again, Art.
Hey, thank you.